Thank you for your patience as we get started here a little bit late. The subject that we're going to be talking about this evening is classical apologetic methodology. This is continuing our study of Christian apologetic methods. And last week we introduced the classical approach as a particular method or theory or approach to Christian apologetics that puts a heavy emphasis or premium or priority on logic, on rationality, and specifically on deductive reasoning as the basic tool for defending the Christian faith, for showing the reasonableness of Christianity. And we noted that the argument, ideal argument from a classical perspective, the ideal apologetic, is one in which the argument for Christianity proceeds from premises that cannot be questioned, using a method that can also not be questioned, to a conclusion, therefore, that follows with rational certainty. Now, this is an ideal, and there are people who are in the classical tradition that recognize it merely as an ideal, not as something that can actually be attained. There are others who think it can be attained. And so there are differences of opinion even within the classical approach as to just how far one can go with that, or how close one can approach that particular ideal. But nevertheless, I think it would be fair to say that the mainstream classical approach to apologetics has viewed the deductive certainty of a purely rational, logical, deductive argument as the best sort of argument one can have for the truth of a conclusion, if you can come up with such an argument. Let's put it that way. And we looked at some different examples of classical apologists. We noted that they are quite different from one another. They are not all fitting into the same cookie cutter, but nevertheless, there is a reason for putting them in the same category, and that in terms of the essential method of defending the Christian faith beyond this, the purely rational issue of the use of logic, we noted that it is typical or characteristic of the classical approach to use what I described, and I'm not original in describing it this way, as a two-step approach or a two-step argument for the truth of Christianity. Step one, show that God exists. Prove theism, T-H-E-I-S-M. Step two, having established the existence of God, prove that God has revealed himself supernaturally in the Bible and in Jesus Christ. This second stage of the argument, according to most classical apologists, will not be purely deductive in form. It is not possible to offer a purely deductive argument, one that does not require some inductive study of the facts in order to ascertain or to show reasonably that Christianity is true. There will be some empirical examination of evidence. Nevertheless, deductive reasoning will still be given as much use and play as possible, even in the second stage of the apologetic. So again, classical apologists use what could be described as a 1-2 punch kind of approach to defending the gospel, defending Christianity. First, show on the basis of a as rationally tight an argument as possible that God exists. And the second punch, the knockout punch, is to show that the evidence demonstrates that this God has revealed himself in Jesus Christ and in the Bible. All right, now, we looked at C.S. Lewis, we looked at Norman Geisler as examples of people who followed this particular approach. There are many other individuals. We mentioned William Lane Craig as a classical apologist. We noted that when Bill Craig is engaged in the second stage of the argument, as we described it, then he sounds like an evidentialist, because typically classical apologists and evidentialists do use the same arguments at that stage. And we noted that there are a variety of other individuals, of course, who fit into the classical tradition in apologetics as well. Now what we're going to do this evening is we're going to go in a little bit more depth and see the way that classical apologists often argue in defense of Christianity, and we're going to see this logical deductive approach, this penchant for presenting matters in a deductive fashion, in a rational fashion, played out in regard to several different issues that have to be addressed in Christian apologetics. So what we're really aiming to do here is to go in a little bit more in depth in the specific arguments used. Last week we really kind of gave a general overview of the way classical apologists like to argue, the basic structure of the argument, but we noted that there were certain arguments that we had only touched upon that obviously needed to be further developed. And so what we're going to do here is to do that. We're going to look at these arguments in more depth, and hopefully we'll get a better feel for the way classical apologists reason. Now, I'd like to start by talking about the way that classical apologists typically go about trying to establish theism. Now, it is a commonplace, especially among classical apologists, to speak about this as an exercise in comparing competing worldviews. A worldview is, the term worldview is perhaps a little bit misleading, but nevertheless, it's the common English term used here. A worldview is a belief system, an overarching belief system that gives a basic answer to the question about the existence of the world and the existence of God, if there is one, and how the two are related. So a more accurate description might be a God and world view or something like that. And there are a variety of worldviews, of course, in our world today. People in the world have different views of the world and different views about God. And apologists all recognize this. They all find this to be of significance in one way or another. But they have different ways of going about looking at the issue of worldviews. I'm going to talk here about a typical or a characteristic approach that classical apologists will take to looking at different worldviews and comparing them with the Christian worldview, which is identified as a form of theism. Now, I wish I could represent this in a diagram for you here, but on just listening, it might be a little bit difficult, but I think that you'll be able to follow along. And you might want to try to draw a diagram based on what I'm saying here. Now, if you have Faith Has Its Reasons, the book that I co-authored on this subject of Christian apologetic methods, in the second edition, what I'm going to talk about here is on page 93. I think it'll be fairly easy to follow along because, in fact, the argument is a fairly simple one. What classical apologists want to do in looking at the different worldviews is to suggest that there are ways of eliminating from the field various worldviews in such a way that you can reduce the options down until you get down to the only one that is viable, being theism. So you could look at this as an argument by process of elimination. It is an attempt to show that there is only one worldview that accounts for reality as we know it, and that worldview is theism. And the way this is done is by posing a series of black and white alternatives, either or alternatives. And so I'm going to go through this, and as you'll see, the attempt here is to cover all the bases so that no one can say, well, you didn't consider my point of view, and at the end of the day show that theism is the best worldview. And again, this is done by posing a series of alternative positions, and in each case, the two that are being posed are mutually exclusive, At least that is how they are normally understood. And they cover all the possibilities. In other words, there isn't a third that could be considered. This is a kind of an argument that appeals to a deductive mind. The idea here is it's either X or it is not X. If it is X, then certain things follow. If it is not X, then other things follow. But it's either X or not X. Now, that is a standard maneuver in deductive reasoning, is to pose two alternatives and say only one of these can be true. And, in fact, one of them must be. You can't say, well, there's a third possibility. And so as we look at this, you'll see how this follows along. All right, first of all, we could start in several places, but we'll start what might be the absolute beginning of this thought process here and say that one must either hold a view about the world, that is, one must either affirm a worldview or not affirm a worldview. You either do or you don't. If you don't affirm any worldview at all, then you would be an agnostic. All right? You would hold to agnosticism. Agnosticism is, in the broadest sense, the position that one does not have a position with regards to the worldview question. So an agnostic says, I don't know if atheism is true, I don't know if theism is true, I don't know if pantheism is true or any other ism is true, I don't know. I cannot seem to reach a decision. And someone who holds to agnosticism as a settled viewpoint thinks it is not possible to reach a decision on these questions, that the evidence is not there to reach any kind of firm conclusion. And so he says, we really just need to admit we don't know. There are other people who also would describe themselves as agnostics who would say, I'm not saying it isn't possible to know. I'm simply saying I don't know yet. I'm looking. I'm trying to find out. Now, that kind of agnostic seems to be rather rare these days. Most people who call themselves agnostics think that it is not possible to make a determination as to which worldview, if any, is correct. But the fact of the matter is, as classical apologists will point out, that an agnostic is really going to be operating on the basis of some kind of assumed worldview. In other words, the agnostic may say that he or she does not have a particular worldview or does not know which worldview is correct, but it's a sure bet that he's living according to a particular worldview, that he's acting as if a certain worldview is correct. Now, if you've got a person who says that he's agnostic, and he never prays, and he never worships, and he does not believe the Bible or does not regard the Bible as a source of authority in his life, or as a source of moral guidance, and is not participating in any kind of religious organization, does not regard any other scriptures as having any kind of normative guidance function in his life, does not participate in any kind of religious rituals or religious obligations of any kind, basically looks to his own intuition or his own sense or his own rationality to make decisions about how to live life, well then, this person is living as, in practical terms, as if he were an atheist. In other words, he may not be out there saying there is no God, but he certainly is living like there isn't God. And obviously, there are a lot of people like that. In fact, there are a lot of people who would say that they believe in God, but who live as if there is not. So, in fact, we really ought to ask two questions here. Number one, what is the worldview to which you intellectually subscribe? And then second, is that actually how you're living? And I'm afraid some of us who profess to be Christians might be caught in a little embarrassment there if we were to, you know, be honest about that second question, that perhaps we profess to believe in Christ, believe in the Bible and so forth, but perhaps we don't live like it. So that's an important question. But in any case, an agnostic is not able to escape the problem of how to go about living life in regards to these questions, so that one of the problems with agnosticism as a stopping point in the pursuit of knowledge, as a settled viewpoint, is that it is inherently unstable because it really ends up assuming a materialistic, non-theistic, and even atheistic perspective. So the classical apologist will urge upon the agnostic, that it's fine to say you don't know yet, but if you're going to be a person who is assiduously pursuing truth, you can't stop at agnosticism, because if you do, you're really stopping at atheism without admitting it. And so what you need to do is to pursue the issue until you have decided whether or not you actually are prepared to affirm that there is no God, and you need to do that. So now we move to the second stage of the argument, and that is either there is nothing that is divine, or there is something that is divine. So there's no divine, or there is divine. Again, you see, you have two alternatives, and there is no third possibility. You can't say, well, there is neither anything divine, nor is there something divine. Obviously, it has to be one or the other. And so the classical apologist will urge that we must move on to the question of whether there is no God at all, nothing divine of any sort, or whether there might be some kind of divine aspect to reality, or divine being of some kind, or beings. But, you know, there has to, you know, either there is something divine, or there is not. Now, the atheist, of course, is the one who says there is nothing that is divine. Classical apologists will appeal to various arguments to show that atheism is not able to account for things that even atheists recognize as existing, as real, and therefore atheism is not a credible worldview. And we're going to talk about the kinds of arguments that the classical apologists use at this point, but let's move on, because we want to understand the structure of the argument. So having established, hopefully, that there is something divine, or at least shown that if you say there is, if you deny atheism, if you admit that atheism won't hold up, then you have to acknowledge there is something that is divine, then the classical apologist moves to the third stage of the argument, which is to say either this divine reality is many or it is one. Either there is and by many I simply mean more than one, but typically those who say there is more than one say there are many. So either there is more than one divine reality, or there is only one divine reality. If you say there is more than one divine reality, or divine thing, then you are a polytheist. A polytheist is somebody who argues for, believes in, a plurality of divinities, a plurality of divine things. Whether they are regarded as personal or not, they typically are regarded as personal in polytheism, but they don't have to be. So one either affirms that there are many gods, or that there is only one God, and one God is not theism necessarily. It's just that's one option for the belief that there is one God, but nevertheless, we're obviously getting a lot closer to theism if we say that there is only one God. So either there is a plurality of gods, or there is only one God. The classical apologist will argue rightly, may I just say frankly, he argues rightly, that polytheism is not a satisfactory worldview, because one, if you have a plurality of deities, you've got to explain how they all came about. In polytheism, the gods are not eternal. They came from somewhere. They were birthed in some way. They may be immortal, but they're not eternal. They're not the ultimate absolute reality. Even in classical Greek civilization, in classical Greek culture and religion, the gods, though they were immortal, were not the ultimate explanation of the universe. They themselves lived in the universe. They lived on Mount Olympus. They were not perfect beings. They were not eternal in the classical Christian sense, the transcendent sense. And there was recognized in Greek religion and philosophy that there was some kind of divine absolute reality that even transcended the gods. So that the classical apologist at this point is simply pressing the polytheist to acknowledge that there must be something behind the gods, something that gives the gods their form and their existence and their nature, that is self-explanatory in a way that the gods of polytheism are not. This is an argument that convinced many Greeks long before it was even being used by Christians. And it is an argument that has typically won the day in terms of cultural civilizations. The number of civilizations or cultures in the world that are avowedly polytheistic has shrunk. Now, interestingly enough, polytheism is making something of a comeback in our post-Christian Western civilization, but that's because we have lost our concern about worldviews being rational, and that's certainly a point that would be pressed by the classical apologist. All right, so having established that if there are beings of amazing kind that seem to be gods to us, or that are regarded as somehow transcending the physical mundane existence we know, that isn't really the absolute reality that explains everything, that underlies everything. And so there must be one divine reality that is absolute. And at this point, then we have the affirmation that there is one God, and we move to the fourth stage of the argument. You can see this is a rather involved argument in that it requires several little steps to the argument. But on the other hand, it's a simple argument in that at every turn it presses one to make a choice between two alternatives, and it's fairly easy to see that those are the only two alternatives. So in that sense, it's a simple argument, and one of the things that classical apologists like about these kinds of arguments is their elegance, their simplicity, it's fairly easy to track with the argument, and that's one of the things that they like about it. Now, if there is one divine reality, according to classical apologists, you have to make another choice, and that is this divine reality finite or infinite? Is it finite or infinite? Well, if it's finite, again, the classical apologist argues it's difficult to understand how it can be the ultimate or absolute explanation for everything that there is. And this is an argument that will have to be pursued and developed in order for it to be persuasive, perhaps, to people who hold to some form of a finite deity. But nevertheless, this is the point that would be pressed. Now, actually, there are two varieties of belief in a finite God, one of which says that this finite God is impersonal, and that would be panentheism. And I better write that one down. Panentheism, notice the EN after the pan, so this is not the same thing as pantheism, which we'll talk about in a bit. Panentheism says that God is the divine reality that is in the world, that gives the world its order and its direction, but it's not a person. It's a divine force or a divine power of some kind. There are different ways of articulating that, but it is like the soul that inhabits the body of the universe. And so it's not a person, but it's a force that gives makes the possibility of persons within the universe a possibility, but it's not a divine being in the classical sense. And this view really is a complicated view as to even whether God should be described as finite, because there's a sense in which the panentheist would say that God is both finite and infinite. We'll accept that as a yes answer to the question whether God is finite, even though, again, classical apologists would say that's not credible to say both, but that's essential to the panentheist view, that there is a finite and an infinite aspect to God. The other finite view of God is called, whenever it's given a name, which isn't very typical, but it is called finite godism, and this views God, frankly, as a person, but denies that God is infinite in his being, that God is rather a finite being, and specifically, and this is the crucial point for, I think, pretty much everybody who holds to finite godism, that God is finite in power, as well as possibly in knowledge, but certainly finite in power. Now, why would anybody hold to finite godism? Well, to explain why God, who for other respects would seem to be a perfectly nice, loving God, a good God, why a good, loving, kind God would not stop things like the Holocaust and Hurricane Katrina and so forth. The answer, according to finite godism, is he can't. There's just so much that you can do if you're a deity, and these are the kinds of things that God cannot do. Rabbi Harold Kushner is a good example of somebody in the current climate, intellectual climate, who is a staunch advocate for finite godism. Of course, as you can tell by his title, Rabbi Kushner is Jewish. He's a Jewish rabbi. And Rabbi Kushner's argument basically in why bad things happen to good people is God is a very busy God. He has a universe to run. It's not easy to do. There's just so much that God can do in a day. So we need to cut him some slack and understand that God is very kind and very gracious and very loving and very good, but he's just not powerful enough. He doesn't have the wherewithal to intervene and stop all of these little things from happening. If he could, he would. He hasn't, so obviously he doesn't have the power to do that. Now, classical theists, classical Christian apologists, argue at this point that finite godism is internally incoherent, because a God that can create the universe and can do anything at all, really, is certainly capable of doing something to ameliorate evil or to prevent certain things from happening, and therefore to say that God is not able to stop the Holocaust, God is not able to save more people out of Hurricane Katrina, God isn't able to do these things. Well, this God is not just less than omnipotent, less than infinite, he's impotent. He really doesn't have the power to do what finite godism requires him to do, which is to create the universe out of nothing. And so there will be a critique of finite godism along those lines. Now, if you agree that God cannot be finite, according to the classical argument at this stage, then you have to affirm that God is infinite. And you can see again that these logically exhaust the possibilities. Either God is finite or God is infinite. And the only position on the market that tries to have it both ways is panentheism, which says that God has a finite and an infinite aspect to him. Everybody else would agree that you've got to choose. The classical apologists will argue, of course, that the infinite God, the infinite one God, is the philosophically cogent and plausible way to go. All right, so let me just review where we are so far. We've said you've got to choose between agnosticism and pursuing some kind of decision as to what worldview that you're going to hold. Second stage, having decided that agnosticism is not a stopping point, you've got to choose between no divine at all, which is atheism, or some kind of divine reality. The third stage is to recognize that there's either a plurality of gods, as in polytheism, or a single God. And then the fourth stage is to argue that this God is either finite, this one God, is either finite or infinite. And then, having established that it is an infinite God, the classical apologist then moves to the fifth stage of the argument, if I'm counting my stages correctly, and that is to argue that this one infinite God is either impersonal or personal. If this one God is impersonal, then what you have is pantheism. An impersonal infinite God would simply be a divine reality that was somehow indistinguishable in any kind of ultimate way from the universe. And so those who hold to one God that is infinite and yet impersonal would affirm some form of pantheism. Now, without necessarily knocking the way the classical apologist is arguing at this point, I think it is fair to say that there are varieties of all these views, and that is certainly consistent with this form of reasoning, this form of argument. But it's also true to say that the lines between an impersonal and a personal view of the deity are somewhat blurry in reality. In other words, there are views of the divine that are personal, that are semi-personal, and that are fully impersonal. And so there, you know, the at this point, one could argue. Now, logically, you could still say either God is personal or impersonal. And that this is the beauty, the strength of the classical argument, that those would seem to be the logically exhaustive categories, but nevertheless, it is a fact that the way people actually think about God is sometimes not easy to classify as either a personal view or an impersonal view. And so what one then has to do is to argue, well, this particular position really affirms that God is personal, but does not do so in a consistent or coherent fashion, or this view affirms that God is impersonal, but does not do so consistently. And that's a perfectly legitimate line of criticism if you can show that to be the case. But the classical apologist that will then argue, you must choose between an impersonal view of the divine and a personal view. And having argued that the impersonal view will not work, and again, if we have time, we'll try to get into why that is the case. The classical theist, a classical apologist, will argue that God must be personal as well as infinite. Now, we are getting very close to theism, and we really are only one small step away. So again, five stages. We've argued against agnosticism. We've argued against atheism. We've argued against polytheism. We've argued that God must be infinite rather than finite, and therefore rejected finite godism and panentheism. And then, having shown that God is one and infinite, we've argued that God is personal rather than impersonal, rejecting pantheism. And there's really only one step left, and that is to argue that this one infinite personal God, either he does do miracles or he does not do miracles. If he does not do miracles, this is what is known as deism. Deism is basically a Christian heresy. That is to say, it is a view of God that originated within the Christian West as an alternative to the classic theistic view that is traditional and orthodox in Christianity. Deism says there is one infinite personal God who created the universe out of nothing, but for some reason does not and possibly cannot do miracles. Now, there are variations on this. There are deists who say, well, God could do miracles, but he wouldn't. There are deists who say God can't do miracles. And so there are some variations here. But the bottom line is the deist says, for whatever reason, God does not do miracles. God never intervenes in his creation. He does not perform supernatural acts of intervention in the natural order. He does not raise the dead. He does not part the Red Sea. He doesn't do that sort of thing, whether he could or not. And the deist sometimes will say he can't. Sometimes he'll say it's beneath him, or God refuses to do that sort of thing, even if he could. Nevertheless, at the end of the day, the deist says God doesn't do miracles. The theist, T-H-E-I-S-M, theism. Theism affirms that God, in fact, can and does perform miracles, that God is a miracle-performing being. And so now we have theism. The theist maintains that God is one, that God is infinite, that God is personal, and that this God performs miracles. And this is the definition, if you will, of theism, is someone who holds this particular constellation of views with regards to God. Now, if we wanted to get all the way to Christianity, because theism, of course, includes classically the views of Judaism and Islam, as well as Christianity, we would then have to pose one more alternative, and that alternative would be between viewing God as triune, as in Christianity, or viewing God as Unitarian or as unipersonal, as in Judaism, Islam, and some Christian heresies. So as you can see, this argument is a kind of process by elimination argument that seeks to show in a fairly rigidly logical, deductive fashion, as much as possible, that there is only one worldview that is intellectually coherent, acceptable, etc. And that worldview is theism, and perhaps even more specifically Christian theism, but really at this point we're focusing on getting to theism. Now, there may be subpoints in critiquing some of these other worldviews that would not follow in the kind of rigidly deductive fashion that we're describing here. But nevertheless, you can see that the structure of the overall argument is a relentlessly deductive one. Either this or this is true. This first option is not a viable option, therefore the second one is the only one that will work. And then just to continue arguing in that fashion until you have eliminated all of the non-theistic worldviews and theism is left standing triumphant. All right, now I'm going to present another argument that's very similar in structure. In fact, it's really identical in structure. That is a specific argument for theism. Now, again, as I've said, there are variations on these arguments, and there are ways of developing these arguments that are more or less deductive, that more or less draw upon factual empirical evidence and support. But the basic structure of the argument, you can see, is quite deductive in form in the overall layout of the argument. The argument that I'm going to talk about here is the Kalam cosmological argument. And let me write that out here. The Kalam cosmological argument. Kalam is an Arabic term, and this is referring to a specific kind of argument used originally by Islamic medieval Muslim philosophers in defense of theism, and it is now an argument that is very popular in evangelical Christian apologetics and has been basically given its currency and its popularity in American evangelical apologetics by Bill Craig, William Lane Craig. And again, like the argument that I just laid out that seeks to show that there are only so many possible worldviews and, you know, we can eliminate all but theism by a process of elimination, the Kalam argument, as William Lane Craig lays it out, follows the same structure. The argument begins with the observation that there is a universe. The universe exists. Now, you could see that the desire to start with a simple premise like this, and one that is going to be acceptable and accepted by virtually everybody one encounters, is very typical of what you're looking for if you're a classical apologist. You want an argument that starts with as few premises as possible, and you want the premises to be as unobjectionable as possible. You want people to look at that and say, well, duh, you know, sure, okay, the universe exists. And that seems, you know, like a long way from proving that God exists for some people, but the argument is intended to proceed from this innocent premise that virtually everybody would have to concede is true to the conclusion that God exists. All right, so you start with the premise that the universe exists. And again, I think the only people that would dispute this are people who are just dying to get away from any kind of apologetic argument at all. They don't care whether it's true or not. You need not waste your time. So Dr. Craig says then, this universe either had a beginning or it did not have a beginning. All right, so either it had a beginning or it didn't. Now, as you can see, those are logically exhaustive possibilities. There is no third possibility in which it had a beginning, neither had a beginning nor did not have a beginning. If it did not have a beginning, then it did not have a beginning. It's A or non-A. And this is the way, again, classical apologists like to argue. They like to limit the number of possibilities deductively so that it gives the non-Christian a little room to escape the force of the argument. All right, now, does the universe have a beginning? William Lane Craig, like most classical apologists, will, of course, argue that the physical evidence of creation modern science has demonstrated that the universe had a beginning. But, like a good classical apologist, Dr. Craig also argues that we can show philosophically that the universe could not have had a beginning. Now, why does he do this? Well, because, as a classical apologist, he's interested in closing any kind of intellectual loophole by showing that through a simple process, and in this case I would have to say a not-so-simple process of deductive argument, not simple in the sense of it does take some doing to kind of go through the whole argument, but by a process of deductive argument, you can show that it is not possible that the universe had a beginning. Then you're not at the mercy of the empirical evidence, which changes from day to day. You're not at the mercy of having to check Scientific American to see if somebody has come up with an argument that might explain the current state of affairs in terms of the evidence through the vehicle of a worldview that, in which the world has no beginning. You don't have to worry about that. You know, the evidence may change, but the possibilities will never change, and so the logic of the argument will never change. And so this is why the classical apologist does this. He's looking for a way to close down all possible loopholes where it doesn't even really matter what the physical evidence may be. At this stage, we are convinced, if we're classical apologists, that we can come up with an argument in which the day-to-day vicissitudes and changes of the empirical evidence and the scientific data and the various scientific theories do not affect the argument. So the classical apologist argues that the universe did not have a beginning and will appeal to the evidence for the Big Bang today, of course, and rightly so, as confirming that the universe did not have a beginning. But Craig and other classical apologists like J.P. Moreland have also used a philosophical argument which has something to do with the question of whether an actual infinite series can exist. And according to the Kalam argument, which Craig and Moreland have presented and defended in their writings, according to the Kalam argument, an actually infinite series of anything is not possible. You could have a potentially infinite series, but not an actual infinite series of things, including an actual infinite series of successive moments. And so, based on that reasoning, the Kalam argument reasons that it is not possible to go backward infinitely in time and continue infinitely backward into the past through an actual infinite series of successive moments and never reach a beginning point. There has to be a beginning point. Now, if there's a controversial part to William Lane Craig's apologetic, this is probably it. There are those who think this is a terrific argument. There are those who are not so impressed. There are those who aren't so sure. And it is a very, very controversial argument. As these kinds of philosophical arguments tend to be, ironically, even though they seem to be operating on the basis of a simple deductive principle. Now, I'm not going to go into all the whys and wherefores of the argument and how the argument is developed in Craig and Moreland's writings, but suffice to say that it's an intriguing argument. It's an argument that shows, if it's successful, that the universe cannot have always existed. Now, it turns out that most Christian apologists think such an argument is no longer needed, although it might be useful to bring out. It's no longer needed because the scientific evidence is now overwhelming that the universe has not always existed. Now, Carol, you're asking a very important question. Does this argument show that God also cannot be eternal? And the answer is no, it doesn't show that, because God does also, according to Craig's understanding of God's nature, God has not existed through himself, through an actually infinite series of or successive events going back infinitely into a past with no beginning. But rather, God's existence before creating the world was a timeless one. And when he created the world, it began a series of potentially infinite successive moments that will never come to an end, but is not an actual infinite series of events. This, again, is a controversial question. Craig's understanding of God's relationship to time is one on which Christian philosophers cut their teeth as a very difficult philosophical question. But in Craig's view, God was timeless before he created the world. God is not timeless now. There are other Christian apologists who think God remains timeless after creating the world, that he still is timeless and transcends time in a sense that would could be described as God being timeless. Very difficult questions here, very philosophically difficult ground. I'm not going to try to sort all that out for us here. I just introduce that as a wrinkle in Craig's philosophical argument for the universe having a beginning that has been a focal point of much of his research and much of his writing, and continues to be a significant subject of debate and controversy even among evangelicals. If you go to the Evangelical Theological Society's annual convention, every year there are papers, I think, presented on the subject. The last time I went, there were probably three or four. It's a difficult question, and again, there is no one view that all evangelical Christians or all Orthodox Christians hold on some of these issues about God's relationship to time. Now, the point here is that, though, that Craig believes, and classical apologists who use the Kalem argument typically believe, that it is possible to establish that the universe had a beginning. Now, I should mention that there are versions of the cosmological argument that don't require you to argue that God has a beginning, that the universe has a beginning, and that God, therefore, is the one who began it. In fact, the Thomistic cosmological argument, the one developed by Thomas Aquinas, and the one favored by Norman Geisler, who is basically Thomistic in his approach to defending theism. The Thomistic cosmological argument does not require as a premise that the universe had a beginning. It proceeds from other aspects of the universe's nature, typically that the universe has the nature of being contingent rather than necessary, and it seeks to show that, therefore, the universe is not self-explanatory and there must be something that sustains the universe in its existence. Thomas Aquinas was of the opinion that it was not possible to prove that the universe had a beginning. He thought that was an item of revelation, something that we knew only because God had revealed it in Scripture. So it's rather interesting to contrast Thomas's view on this and Geisler's view on this with the Kalam argument, and the as especially in contemporary circles as defended by William Lane Craig. Now, having established that the universe had a beginning, and again, Craig covers his bases nicely. If you don't like the philosophical argument, he's got a scientific one. If you don't like the scientific one, he's got a philosophical one. Having established that the universe had a beginning, Craig asks the next question. And it's an obvious question. Was this beginning caused, or was it not caused? Is this beginning of the universe simply a brute fact? It just began with no explanation, no causation, no origination, other than it simply just burst into existence for no reason or no... For no cause of any sort, or was it caused? And Craig argues that it must have been caused. That anything that anything that begins to exist must be precipitated in that beginning in some way. There must be something that begins it, that causes it to begin. And this is a point on which philosophers have argued with Craig. And not all philosophers have bought this particular point of the argument. For obvious reasons, there are philosophers that have argued with Craig's Kalam argument every step of the way, other than whether the universe exists. They all concede that one. But there, that is a subject of dispute as well. If the universe exists and it had a beginning, must it have been either caused or not caused? And, of course, Craig would argue those are the only two logical possibilities. And if it can't exist by simply not by simply beginning without a cause, then there has to be a cause. Finally, having argued that there is a cause to this beginning, Craig asks, is this cause personal or not personal? And again, this it's A or non-A. Either it is or it isn't. Either it's personal or it's not personal. The cause of the universe, is it personal or not personal? If you say it's personal, then you have arrived at something alike God. Now, Craig agrees that this does not prove everything about God essential to Christian theism. It doesn't even prove everything essential to theism, but it does prove that there is some kind of a divine being who caused the universe to come into existence. It fairly rules out pantheism, because a pantheistic God cannot cause the universe to exist, because the universe is simply another form of God's own being. Craig is prepared to argue that this argument will rule out certain forms of non-theistic worldviews, but it doesn't necessarily prove everything about theism, but it eliminates most of the worldviews that need to be refuted, and leads to the conclusion there's something like a God that creates the universe. All right, so what we're doing at this point, for those who have just joined us, is we're looking at the classical approach to apologetics. We gave an introduction to it last week, but we're now looking at classical apologetics in more depth and looking at some specific arguments used by classical apologists like Norman Geisler, William Lane Craig, and others to try to develop the case for Christianity. We've noted that there is a two-step argument, a basic overall structure of the argument in classic apologetics. The first step is to show that God exists, which is the defense of theism. The second step is to show that the theistic religion that represents the true God is Christianity, that God has revealed himself in the Bible and in Jesus Christ uniquely. All right, so all I've been attempting to do here is to illustrate some of the types of arguments that classical apologists use in defense of Christianity, and I've shown two arguments that approach their specific issue that they're trying to address by a fairly simple structured argument that proceeds by looking at logical alternatives where you only have two possibilities, A or non-A. The universe had a beginning or it did not have a beginning. Either God exists or God does not exist. Those sorts of arguments, and proceed to try to show that the Christian view is the correct view. Now, I want to present one more of these arguments that follows the very same structure. And this argument is one that is very popular in Christian apologetics, especially because it was one that was presented by arguably the most popular Christian apologist of the 20th century, and that was C.S. Lewis. Now, the argument, as I'm going to present it, is a bit more involved, or a bit more, has a couple more steps to it than the way Lewis presented it, because C.S. Lewis only dealt with three possibilities in this famous argument, which became known as the trilemma. But in order to make the argument complete, various Christian apologists since Lewis have pointed out that you need to have some other possibilities considered. So again, the argument is going to follow exactly the same structure as the two arguments we've already looked at. The first argument dealing with worldviews, the second argument dealing with the universe's beginning and proving that there is a God. This argument has to do with the claims of Jesus Christ. Now, at this point, we are in stage two, or step two, of the classical apologist argument. We have established theism. We've established that God exists, that there is a God who created the world, and we are now asking, has this God made himself known in Jesus Christ and in the Bible, and specifically in Christ? So we're going to be looking at that, and again, if you're trying to follow along in Faith Has Its Reasons, this is on page 110. I realize not all of you are reading the book, and that's fine, but if you're interested, that's where this is. And I'm going to elaborate on this in some ways that you aren't finding in the book, or perhaps not in detail. But basically, the argument begins with a premise that is, again, this is standard operating practice, standard operating procedure for classical apologists, to start with a premise that is very difficult to dispute. And that premise is that the New Testament reports that Jesus claimed to be deity. Now, that's pretty clear. There are plenty of statements in the New Testament Gospels reporting that Jesus viewed himself as more than a man, that Jesus viewed himself as the divine Son of God. Now, they may have Christians who've read this may have come up with somewhat different interpretations as to what that means, but virtually everybody agrees that the Gospels, as we have them, present Jesus as claiming to be divine or deity in some sense. Now, and if you are curious about this, if you are skeptical about this even, you don't know that the New Testament Gospels report Jesus claiming to be divine. If you have any doubts about that, if I may be forgiven for a little 10-second commercial here, take a look at a book that I co-authored called Putting Jesus in His Place, The Case for the Deity of Christ. And you can find the information on that at deityofchrist.com. And that book is entirely devoted to showing that the New Testament presents Jesus as God, including all four of the Gospels. All right, so end of that commercial. But the argument that we're looking at here, C.S. Lewis's trilemma, expanded a bit to cover all of the possible contingencies here. We can develop the argument in this fashion. Either the reports in the New Testament are true, or they are not true. They are either true or they are false. That is, either the New Testament is correct in telling us the historical truth that Jesus made this claim to be divine, or it is not true that Jesus claimed to be the divine, and the New Testament reports are in this respect entirely false. Notice that they don't have to be entirely true. In other words, this argument is not saying either the Bible is inerrant or it is not inerrant. That's not the argument here. We are not bringing in the inerrancy or inspiration of the Bible at this point whatsoever. The classical apologist does not want that brought into the argument until the very end. At this point, the classical apologist is merely asking us to agree that the New Testament reports that Jesus claimed to be divine, and then asks us to decide either these reports are entirely false, or it is in fact the case that Jesus, at least on some occasions, perhaps not every occasion reported in the Gospels, perhaps not in the exact words reported in the Gospels, but nevertheless, that in some way or another, Jesus did in fact claim to be divine. And you've got to choose. Now, once you see that everywhere you turn in Jesus' speech in the Gospels, that Jesus talks as if he's more than just a regular Joe. When you understand that the belief in Jesus' deity pervades the New Testament records of what Jesus said, as well as what he did, it becomes harder to argue that these reports are entirely false, and that would have to be the conclusion. But there are those who do take that view. So logically, you either have to argue that the reports are true or that they are entirely false. If they are entirely false, then it is a legend. So this would be the first of our options that is to be considered and rejected according to the classical apologist, that the gospel reports are entirely legendary with regards to the claims of Jesus. Now, if they're not entirely legendary, then it is true that Jesus claimed to be divine. If it's true, then, again, the classical apologist who's trying to cover all the bases, all the possibilities, would say, either Jesus meant this mystically, or he meant it literally. Now, if Jesus meant it mystically, what he was saying was not that he was uniquely divine, or that he was uniquely God incarnate, but rather Jesus would be saying something like an Eastern guru might say, an Eastern mystic, that I, like everyone else, is part of the divine. We are all part of God. God is part of all of us. We are all part of the great ocean of divinity. And the sea is churning, and we see these little drops coming up out of the ocean, but they're still part of the ocean. They will return to the ocean. And therefore, when Jesus claims to be divine, he's only claiming to be part of this great cosmic divine reality that we're all part of. Now, this view then would view Jesus as a kind of llama. We're going to continue the L's here, as you probably guessed. And so the Lama view says Jesus did claim to be divine, but he meant it mystically. He meant that we are all part of the divine reality. We are all part of God. Well, the Christian apologist then would argue that if you look at the historical context of Jesus' statements, it is clear that Jesus did not understand this mystically, that Jesus was Jewish in his theology, that Jesus was a monotheist, and therefore it does not really make sense to claim that Jesus was making these statements in a mystical sense. And furthermore, the classical apologist will remind us at this point that he has already established theism as the true worldview, and therefore the pantheistic worldview required to establish the Lama position will not hold up. And so, having shown that Jesus meant it literally and not mystically, we now have the conclusion at this point that Jesus claimed to be God in literally claiming to be the creator of the universe, the divine being responsible for our existence, incarnate. Now, either this is true or it is not true. If it is true, then Jesus is the Lord. He is indeed the Lord, creator of the universe, the Lord God, if it's true. If it's not true, of course, then it's false. Jesus claimed to be God, but he really wasn't God. And here's where C.S. Lewis's trilemma comes into play. If Jesus claimed to be God, but he was not, then he was either a liar, according to C.S. Lewis, or a lunatic, a crazy man. If he knew it was false, he was a liar. If he did not know it was false, if he really thought he was God, but of course was not, then Lewis says obviously he was deranged, he was a lunatic. So those exhaust the possibilities. You cannot be, you cannot think that you are God, have it not be true, and be neither a liar nor a lunatic. You've got to be one of those. And so, according to Lewis, if Jesus claimed to be God, and you are not prepared to say that he was a liar or that he was a lunatic, then you're stuck. That Jesus really did, if you admit that Jesus claimed to be the Lord of creation, then he must be. And therefore, Jesus Christ is the Lord God. So we have five possibilities that are examined here. The legend view, the llama view, the liar view, the lunatic view, and all of those are shown to be implausible in the extreme, and this leaves us with the conclusion that Jesus is Lord. Now, I suppose there might be a few people out there who are prepared to argue that Jesus was a liar or that Jesus was a lunatic, but I have, frankly, yet to meet any. In 30-some years of talking with people about this and reading materials from skeptics and other non-Christians, it's very difficult to find any that will agree that Jesus was someone who claimed to be God, but was incorrect about that. Non-Christians almost always favor the legend view or the llama view. The liar and lunatic options are not live options for most non-Christians. Now, someone's asking at this point, and I think it's fine to go ahead and address this, why do some people who say they believe in Christ say that he is Lord but not God? Now, I'm using the term Lord here as a synonym for God, which in biblical usage it typically is, but it's a fair question, and that is there are those who are attempting to show in their interpretation of the Bible that Jesus claimed to be a kind of semi-divine being, a supernatural created being whom God gave authority over the rest of the cosmos, over the rest of creation, as its supreme Lord under his direction. And this would be the Arian view of ancient Arianism. This would be the Jehovah's Witness view, etc. It's not the biblical view. And again, if I may be permitted to reference it again, putting Jesus in his place, the case for the deity of Christ, at deityofchrist.com, you can find information about that book. I go into all of the biblical evidence on this question that I can in the space of one book, and address arguments from Jehovah's Witnesses and others on this particular subject. But it's a fair point that, again, there are those who would dispute that Jesus actually claimed to be God, but they would admit that Jesus said what the Gospels report, and they have a different interpretation of it. So, as with any argument, there are some fine points that have to be examined, some footnotes that have to be added to clarify certain things or to support certain things. But the argument that C.S. Lewis is developing here is really aimed at the skeptic who is saying, well, I'm sure Jesus was a very nice fellow. I'm sure he was a great teacher. You know, they like the Sermon on the Mount, turning the other cheek and all of that stuff. That's quite fine and, you know, lovely sentiments, but we don't have to trust in Jesus Christ and follow him to the ends of the earth and all this other stuff, because Jesus was just a regular guy, and Christianity is therefore not unique and not the only way and not even necessarily the true way. And we don't have to follow that. And Lewis is at pains to explain to this kind of person that you don't have that option, that Jesus did not leave us with the option of putting him in the category of one of the many great teachers of antiquity and just sort of pigeonholing him and putting him on the shelf as one of the great minds or something like that. That Jesus claimed to be divine, that he claimed to be God, and Lewis points out that anybody who says that is either out of his head or the worst of all liars, or he must really be divine. He must really be God. And I think that part of the argument certainly holds up. If Jesus claimed to be God, then in a theistic context, then those are your options. And that's Lewis's argument. All right, so those are just three examples of the typical sorts of arguments one gets in the classical apologetic approach. Again, the emphasis is on trying to yield conclusions by starting with as few premises as possible, and have those premises be as unobjectionable as possible. That would be very hard to disagree that the universe exists, or that the New Testament Gospels report Jesus claiming to be more than a man, claiming to be a divine person of some kind. And so the goal here in these types of arguments is to start with a limited claim, a modest claim that very few people would dispute, and then to reason as logically as possible, as deductively as possible, through the alternatives to arrive eventually at the conclusion that the Christian perspective on that particular issue is the true answer. And that's a very typical type of argumentative strategy used in classical apologists, by classical apologists. All right. At this point, I would love to get your feedback and your questions, your comments, perhaps something that you have heard that has sparked a question in your mind. It doesn't have to be directly related to these arguments that I've been describing, but perhaps on something indirectly related. And so if you could indicate your interest in asking a question, please do make sure that these are appropriate to why we're here. I think most of us who are here now belong here. But I would invite you to go ahead and ask any questions that you might have. And if you want to type your questions out, that's fine. If you want to take the microphone, I'll be happy to yield the microphone to allow you to ask your questions in that way. So any questions or comments at this point? Jehovah's Witnesses openly say that they do not worship Jesus. They agree that Jesus should not be worshipped from their point of view. Now, I'd have to qualify this. They do have a translation of the Bible called the New World Translation, in which they made a change, I believe it was back in the 1980s, in which they acknowledged in Hebrews 1:6 that the angels worship Jesus. And then they said, well, but they worship him in a relative sense. whatever that means. And Jehovah's Witnesses are very vague as to what it would mean to worship Jesus if he is to be worshipped at all. All right, well, we did get started late, and so I understand that we may need just to go ahead and close up at this point. If you do have questions that come up in your minds perhaps during the week, you might want to make a note of those and bring those next time. And, of course, that would be fine as well. Let me give you a preview where we're going here. Next week, we're going to be starting our discussion of evidentialist apologetics. We'll be looking at the apologetic arguments of people like Gary Habermas and John Warwick Montgomery. And we will be looking at how these arguments differ from classical apologetics, why they differ, what the reason is that these evidentialists prefer a different form of argument. And we'll be introducing that particular approach next week, and we'll continue with evidential apologetics in more depth in the following week. So two weeks of evidentialism coming up in the next 2 weeks, and then we will take a look at Reformed apologetics, including presuppositionalism. And so we will eventually get to that, but in order to understand Reformed apologetics, we really need to look at the classical and evidential approaches first, because Reformed apologetics is really, as a family of apologetic approaches, a reaction against the classical and evidential approaches. So that's why we're going to be going in that particular order. All right, so I think we're probably done for the evening. Unless there's any other questions, we will sign off at this point. And I look forward to spending some more time with you again next week.